welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to our Iditarod coverage here on KVRF 89.7 in the Mattsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site, and you can find all of our episodes over on DogWorksRadio.com. Make sure you check us out over on social media and keep the discussion alive. And joining us from Southern California is our co-host, Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. And, you know, we are right now in the part of the race where almost everybody, certainly almost everybody in the front half of the field has either already taken their 24 or are finishing up their 24. So we're starting to get an idea about halfway through for the leaders who is really out in front right now. And Allie Zirkel was the first of the halfway point at Iditarod, where she's taking her 24. She'll be leaving a little before, I think, 3 in the morning, Alaska time. Martin Boozer also went ahead and got to Iditarod, and he's taking his 24 there. But then at the front of the pack, Nick Petit and your Leifseth Olsson had taken their 24s earlier, so they came through Iditarod and actually are ahead of the pack right now. And it looks like, looking at the tracker right now, it looks like Yor is about 5 miles past the Iditarod checkpoint, and he is still going. And Nick is about 10 miles past the Iditarod checkpoint, and he has been resting there for a couple of hours. So it looks like he either is camping or he found himself a shelter cabin. But these two, along with Allie Zirkel, I think are going to be the ones to watch coming down the stretch, like all the way down the Bering Coast. And I would be very surprised if the winner was not one of these three.
And as they work their way towards the Yukon River, what are the speeds looking like over the last couple of runs, Alex? Are they staying right there at that 7 or 8 miles an hour, or are they picking up the pace a little bit?
So far, it looks like the leaders are staying around 7 or 8 miles per hour. There are some stretches where it's a little bit slower. Allie had relatively slow run coming into Iditarod. I think the trail is, it's still good, but it's not great. There was a storm moving in, which was expected to maybe slow down some of the teams that are following. So we're still looking at a fairly quick pace for the leaders anyway.
And as you know from our trip to Yetna Station the other night, I guess I want to talk a little bit about the trail markers. And the reason I say that is Allie had said in one of the posts on one of the news sites that the trail wasn't very well marked. And as you know, heading down from the Yetna River and from that checkpoint on down, that trail is interestingly marked, isn't it? Some places it's marked every couple of hundred yards, and then there's other spots where it's a while before you see a trail marker, isn't there?
Yeah, and I believe, I'm not positive, but I believe that the goal is to have the trail markers every 100 yards or so, or maybe even more frequently than that. But as you know, these are trail markers put out in places that often are not populated. So if the trail marker gets blown out of where it's, stuck into the snow, it could be, blown over and covered with snow, or it could be blown into the woods if there are woods around there. So it's not unusual for trail markers to kind of go missing during the race. It doesn't mean anything nefarious. It's just that it's difficult to mark a 1,000-mile race where there's a lot of unpredictable weather and have it be totally consistent.
Right. And as you know, Alex, the trail markers are very distinctive. They are a wooden stake about 2.5 inches wide or so. It has a painted bright orange reflective top. It has a little blue flag on it of some type of tape, and then a piece of reflective marking that you can see pretty well with a bright headlamp. And as you mentioned, they should be about every 100 yards or so, but often in areas where the trail is a little bit more open, say on the river or crossing lakes or swamps, they may be a little bit more spread out. But that's a good trivia question, isn't it, Alex? How many trail markers are used on the Iditarod Trail each year? If somebody can correctly answer that question on our social media, maybe we can offer a prize or two.
Yeah, that would be a very interesting question to have answered. And you know, in addition to the regular trail markers, there are also, and I'm not sure what the correct term is for these, but there are, if the trail splits into two, there are markers that sort of are shaped like an X to indicate the trail you're not supposed to take as well. And we saw a lot of those where there was, where the trail would split up and there were options for which way to go. There would be this sort of X marker to indicate not to go on that part of the trail.
That's exactly right. And typically at a hard turn, you know, whether you're going a hard turn left or a hard turn right, they'll put several markers on the inside of that turn to indicate that you're going to be turning in that direction. So it's a little bit easier to find your way down the trail when those are very well marked. But just imagine, Alex, how difficult it would be in the middle of the night with a dim headlamp, maybe the batteries aren't fully charged or whatever, or we're dealing with bad weather and or sleep deprivation. Trail markers may be a difficult thing to follow.
Absolutely. And that's when, you know, you really can rely fairly well on your dogs, unless you're one of the first mushers, because once a bunch of dog teams have gone down the trail, they leave what's sometimes called a scent trail. So the dogs who have very, very sensitive noses and senses of smell can figure out which way the dogs in front of them go and then follow that scent trail, which is all well and good unless there's a team or several teams that take a wrong turn, and then you could potentially have a whole bunch of teams taking that same wrong turn because their dogs are just following the scent trail of the other dogs that came before them.
One last thing in regards to trail. As we said at the top, a lot of the mushers are working their way towards the mighty Yukon River, which is a very wide stretch, very long stretch of trail. I believe it's over 100 miles, if I remember correctly. Can you give a sense of what that trail is like from your trip down the river? We were on the Yetna River and the Big Sioux, and it's about as half as wide as the Yukon. But what do you think about traveling along that river on such a wide expanse that it covers?
You know, it was both really it was both a lot better and in some cases a lot worse than the other parts of the trail because there's been a lot of temperature variations this winter. There were a lot of times where the river would freeze and then it would warm up significantly, so there would be pressure on the water going up. So there were a lot of bumps in that part of the river. Which was not so enjoyable for me. I think it's probably a lot better when you're behind a dog team going 8 or 9 miles per hour than when you're on a snow machine. But that part of it was, and here I am being a wimp about this, a little bit difficult for me. You did much better, but I found it a little bit terrifying when we would go over the bumps and I would, you know, come up off of the snow machine and worry that I would fall off. But for the teams, I think that's a really good way to do it. It's a little bit colder when you're down on the rivers. We were, I think, lucky that, for humans, the temperature was really very nice. It wasn't that cold. It was, probably in the 20s. So it was relatively warm. Wasn't anything that really made me very cold when we were out on the river. I did very much like the having the wider expanse. It's a really beautiful way to see the scenery. I mean, there's a lot of beautiful scenery that you would see on the Iditarod Trail, but that was particularly striking for me. And also I think that there's more of a chance, and this is, again, is probably a lot easier when you're on a snow machine than when you're behind a dog team, but it's a lot easier to find a really good section of trail if you have a wide, a very wide area to choose from. So I would think that you would be able to get a much smoother ride down the river where it's a little wider. We also saw a few instances where there was overflow and a little bit of open water, which always can be a big problem for dog teams. Where we were, it did not seem very serious, and the areas where there was open water was did not look very deep. So we're talking about, a couple of inches or a foot deep, as opposed to on the Yukon, where, if there's open water, you could be looking at something that was very, very deep.
And some dog teams have a real tough time running along the rivers because it truly is just a wide expanse. Think about running down a highway that's almost a mile wide in some sections. And some dogs get really bored with that and have a real tough time navigating down those sections of trail, which can be many miles long. So that is part of a strategy on how teams are trained and ran on the rivers. And it is something that they take very seriously in their training plans to train for a race like this or any others that travels the rivers. Let's jump over to a story that we heard or read about this morning about a broken sled and a scratch musher. What do you have?
Yeah, so this deals with rookie Allison Liefke, who we talked about a few days ago, and she was in Takotna taking her 24-hour rest. She had a really rough time and got stuck in the Farewell Burn outside of Rhone and had a broken sled. Part of the front of her sled was broken, and she was sort of sitting there for 10 hours and contemplating scratching because the sled was undrivable. And she said that she was going downhill and ran into a stump that was covered with a little bit of snow but was mostly just dirt. She lost control of the sled. It hit the stump and got snagged, which crunched the front of her runner. So at that point, she had this sled, which wasn't in any shape for her to continue on and drive on to Nikolai. And so the first thing that she did was she made sure that her dogs were taken care of. She fed the dogs and got them situated. And then she had no idea what she would do. So she was very sleep deprived by this point, as a lot of the mushers are. So she got a little something to eat herself, and she took a 3-hour nap. And when she woke up, she was a little bit more clear-headed and realized that the front of the runner was broken and it was missing a big piece of it. And so it was really not something that she felt that she could continue with. But then another musher stopped and was talking to her and said that and gave her some ideas for how she could fix the sled, not permanently, but fix it enough that she could run with it and get into Nikolai. And he was very encouraging and gave her a bunch of specific ideas. And then he went off and she was able to jury-rig the sled so that it could keep going. And then she got into Nikolai, and apparently there were a lot of other people who'd been having a lot of troubles in the Farewell Burn area and getting their sleds beaten up. And while she was in Nikolai trying to figure out what she could do, because, there are a lot of mushers who will ship second sleds, but usually they'll ship them to McGrath, which is the next checkpoint on from Nikolai. So she wasn't sure what she would do. And then Shani Traska scratched in Nikolai. And so she let Allison borrow her sled. So Allison is now running with Shani Traska's sled, which was in perfectly fine condition. It was her dogs that were not doing so well. So Allison Liska is able to continue on with Shaney's sled. And she told KTVA that people are really nice out here. And even though we're competing with each other, we also like to help each other out. And, you know, this goes back to what we talk about a lot, which is the spirit of cooperation and fellowship that all mushers have when they're out on the trail, even though they are still competing with each other, less so in the middle and the back of the pack, but in the front of the pack, you still will see people who will stop and help each other, even though that may cost them a few minutes or you know, something else. But this is, to me, this spirit of cooperation is really very much what one of the core principles of what the Iditarod is about.
Just a couple quick points on that, Alex. As we've mentioned before on our show, when a person scratches along the trail, and fortunately we've only had one scratch so far, they leave all of their drop bags along the trail from checkpoint to checkpoint, and typically mushers that are working their way down the trail have access to those, whether it be for the human components of that drop bag, whether it be gloves and batteries and whatnot, or the food for the dogs along the trail. And I think that's a really cool part about the community of Iditarod. And you had mentioned that Shaney had allowed Allison to use her sled. And I think that that's really special because, guys, you guys got to remember, these sleds are very expensive. I'm not sure what type of sled that Allison was using, but just as a comparison, I have a couple of sleds from Sled Dog Systems, and we saw at the start that's the predominant sled maker used in Iditarod, and my sled cost about $3,500. So imagine, guys, that, you know, a car breaks down on the side of the road, and then a friend of yours will drive up and say, no problem, just go ahead and take my car and give it back in one piece, and we'll see you later. And that's sort of what it's like when you're dealing with thousands of dollars in sleds. That is an expense that most people can't take lightly. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. And I think the car example is a really good way to look at this. You know, this is something that many people, especially many people in, you know, more well-populated areas would never think of doing. And yet that's exactly the sort of sharing and the sort of spirit of community that we're talking about here.
So you have one other story. It's sort of Iditarod related, but not completely. What are you talking about?
So KTUU is reporting that there was a small plane that was reported missing en route from Rainy Pass to Wasilla. And there is a search underway with the Alaska National Guard. It apparently is a Cessna 172. And Wes Erb, who's the chief pilot for the Iditarod Air Force, said that the plane is not officially affiliated with the race, and it's not clear exactly whose plane it was or who was on board the plane, but it seems likely because it was flying from Rainy Pass to Wasilla, and Rainy Pass is a relatively accessible early checkpoint, that this may have been one of these tour groups that goes out to some of the early checkpoints on small planes. So we don't have any further information, and hopefully everybody is okay. That first, and then once everybody is okay, hopefully the plane is okay. It's possible that it could have gone to another place. It could have landed somewhere else. But we'll keep you guys apprised as we find out anything more about that. But it's people fly up and down the Iditarod Trail a lot. There's a lot of media who fly up and down the trail. There's the official Iditarod Air Force that go up and down the trail all the time. And then there are these tour groups, which are usually relatively expensive things for people who have a fair amount of money and really want to go up the trail and see more of the checkpoints. These are small planes, and for the most part, they are very well maintained and have all modern safety equipment and all of that. But there's something that is always a little bit unpredictable when you are flying up in Alaska on a small plane in an area where there is potentially storms coming in, where there's potentially a lot of different types of weather, where you are not landing at an airport with a paved runway, but you're landing, you know, in the snow or on a lake at a place where there's been a little landing area cleared out. So this is, it's not like you're flying on Alaska Airlines and you know, and you're going to a specific place and everyone knows where it is. This is a little bit, I don't want to say that it's dangerous, but it is definitely more dangerous than these commercial flights that I think most people are used to.
And as we were driving down the river from Willow to Yetna Station, we saw a lot of that air traffic going back and forth, and that is a very popular way to travel along the trail. And I remember as we were working our way, we saw two really fancy helicopters fly over us, and they landed literally in the middle of the river, and a group of tourists got out, and you could tell that they were tourists because they were wearing their fanciest winter clothes. That looks like, they had just bought them on the way to Alaska, and they got out of the helicopters, took some pictures of some teams that went by, jumped back in, and took back off. And that is a very common way for people to follow Iditarod. And you had mentioned weather, Alex. I know that the official Iditarod photographer, Jeff Schultz, who is one that travels down the trail on one of these planes, had to turn around from, I don't know if it was Rainy Pass or Finger Lake the other day, and had to backtrack a little bit and go back to Wasilla because he could not make his way down the trail. So that is a real concern along the rivers and, of course, along the rest of the trail as well.
Yeah, and, obviously we don't know exactly what's happened, so I think at this point all we can do is hope for the best and really put our positive energy and thoughts and prayers into everyone being okay.
I agree. And before we jump over to our musher profile for the evening, do you have any other updates or stories that you'd like to mention?
No, it's been a relatively slow day. With people taking their 24s, just coming off of their 24s. I expect we're going to have a lot more to report in the next day or two, but this was a bit of downtime for Iditarod today.
So let's jump on over to do what we do and do our musher profile for the evening. We're going to talk about a friend of mine. His name is Lev Schwartz. He is a Willow Dog Musher, and he is one of the guys that we were sort of leapfrogging down the trail as we were working our way towards Yetna, and he spoke to us several times as he was driving by with his dog teams as we were parked along the side, and he was asking us things like, are you going to work your way down the trail a little bit this year? And, you know, I think I just saw you, and he has a very interesting sense of humor, and I really enjoy Lev, and I look forward to hearing what you have to say about him today on our profile.
Yeah, Lev is a very distinct personality, and as you said, he has a very sharp sense of humor, sometimes a little bit dark. He is 39 and was born in the Ukraine back before the Soviet Union split up, then moved when he was a kid with his parents to the Boston area. He's now a U.S. citizen. He got a B.S. in electrical engineering at Carnegie Mellon University and then went back to work in the tech sector outside of Boston. And he said that while he was sitting in an air-conditioned office, he decided that He wanted to leave his engineering career to pursue dog mushing. He had one husky starting out, which is a lot of the times the way these stories start is the people will say, well, I had one dog and then I got a bunch of other dogs. And before long, I had to, you know, I had to start competing. So he was in north central Massachusetts, which, by the way, is very near to where I grew up. And they were training and racing in a bunch of local events, but that is not an area that is well known for having good snow. And usually what will happen in the winters is there will be a few big dumps of snow, but then the temperature will go up to 40 or 50 degrees, and then most of the snow will be gone in a couple of days. So he eventually got fed up with the terrible snow conditions and inadequate trail access in the area, and realized that it was time to put up or shut up. So he packed up his stuff and all of his dogs, moved to Alaska, and settled in Willow, where there is great trail access and plenty of mushers to trade information with and generally very good snow conditions. This year, Blair Braverman was talking to Lev, and this is in her article that was in Outside Magazine, and she said that she's gotten to be buddies with him and discussed her concerns and worries about the Iditarod Trail with him, and he said to her, at this point, the dogs aren't going to get any more in shape, so the only thing that can change between now and the Iditarod is their attitude and yours. So in other words, don't let your stress affect your dog team. And that is, I think, very, very good advice. He, at the Mushers Banquet in Anchorage last week, he was glitter bombed by fellow musher Jamie High. And then at the ceremonial start, he passed by Christy Lent, who is a great photographer, and she handed him a dish towel to take on the trail with him that says, dog hair is my glitter. His dog team that he started with going to Nome is Cross, Blue Collar, Snap, Early, Millstone, Coyote, Necktie, VCR, Smallpox, Not Tonight, Cramps, Suicide, 8-Track, and Punch Card. A lot of people will, when they have dog litters, will name their litters after a certain theme. He has a themed litter that are all named after diseases. So he has dogs named dengue, smallpox, malaria, and polio. He has dogs named after outdated technologies. So he has VCR and 8-Track. This year he dropped his dog Coyote in Rainy Pass, who had minor shoulder injuries and is home in Willow now and healing nicely. And Lev's wife said that Coyote is completely bonkers, happy, fat, and angry with Lev for sending her home. His general race plan that he announced and posted on Facebook before the race started was to run to have runs of up to 7 hours with rests of 4 to 5 hours. And his race plan was to get to Rainy Pass around 2 p.m. Monday, and his actual time getting into Rainy Pass was 1:38 p.m. And then he wanted to be at Nikolai at 1 p.m. Tuesday and got there at 12:56, which is almost exactly what he wanted to do. He's taking his 24 in McGrath. He was thinking he would take it either in McGrath or to Katna. So he is very much functioning on his race plan. He's also the type of guy that he now, among other things, does contracting and has a short-run manufacturing shop for small metallic supplies and things like that. So he is constantly posting on Facebook about how he's manufacturing different types of screws and has like different ideas for how to attach runners and other pieces of equipment to his sled. So I would have to say that if you are ever out in the middle of nowhere and you need someone to MacGyver up a specific part to help you with your sled, that Lev Schwartz is the guy that you want by your side. And this is his fourth time entering Iditarod. He scratched in 2014, finished 54th in 2015, 41st place last year, and it looks like he is well on track to have a very respectable middle of the pack finish that increases his standing from last year by maybe 10 places or so.
Yeah, if I could add just a little bit about Lev Schwartz. He and I met several years ago, I think just the first couple of years I was up here, and we became friends. And he and our son Tyler, my son Tyler, spent the better part of a summer building our greenhouse here at our house. And I got to know Lev pretty well, and I got to know that very sharp sense of humor, as you called it at the beginning, and heck of a cool guy, and I wish him the best. I think he's going to do very well this year, and he may be one of those folks that's in contention for most improved musher. What do you think?
Yeah, he definitely could be, because he is running very, very well. He seems to be sticking to his race plan and seems to have a very, very solid race plan. You know, of course, anything could happen in the second part of the race. But I would not at all be surprised if he moved up considerably from his finish last year.
Well, Alex, we're just about out of time, and we have a special musher profile for tomorrow. We're going to talk about your friend Blair Braverman, and I made a point to post an old interview that we did here on Mushing Radio with Blair and I that we did, I don't know, about a year and a half or two ago. And when I posted that and I tagged her and her now infamous hashtag Ugly Dogs, that tweet has been retweeted or liked almost 100 times now. So that just shows that she has a heck of a fan base out there, doesn't it?
She really does. And it's very exciting to have her in the race, not just because she's a friend of ours, but also because she is kind of a social media and regular media rock star. And we'll talk a lot more about that tomorrow. But it's very exciting that she is in the race and she's getting a lot of attention from a lot of mainstream publications that don't usually pay any attention to Iditarod. So we're looking forward to talking a lot more about her tomorrow.
And I'm sure I'll mention this tomorrow, but just in closing, Alex, we've said over and over on this year's coverage, as well as all the years that we've been doing this, I think this is our eighth year now, that we typically spend a lot of our time talking about those middle to the back of the pack mushers, because they don't get the news attention that the Martin Boozer and Jeff King and Dallas Seavey and Yor Olsom and all of those big names in the sport get. But that is the exact opposite with Blair Braverman. I think that she has probably gotten more coverage over this year's Iditarod and done more for the sport in mushing in terms of a positive light and positive reporting than anybody in recent history, hasn't she?
She really has. And, you know, I talk a lot about people who are really great ambassadors for the sport. And I think, you know, I think off the top of my head that one of the people who really stands out in that way is Ali Zirkel. And probably another is Martin Boozer, although he is less someone who interacts a lot with the media. But I think that Blair Braverman is definitely one of the best ambassadors for the sport that has come along in a really long time.
So we'll have an exciting show tomorrow. As we mentioned, a lot of the mushers will be making their way towards the Yukon when we come back on the air tomorrow evening. And we hope to have a really solid top five by that point. And I think we could really start placing our bets if we were betting men at that point. But like you said, it's still a very long race to go. So we'll see how it pans out. And until then, thanks for joining us here on Dogworks Radio and Mushing Radio. And Alex, it's always a pleasure, and we'll talk again soon, okay?
Okay, thanks, Robert.
Thank you. On behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, this is Robert Forto for Mushing Radio. Make sure you tell your friends about our show and hit the right button, and you will get the next episode on your device as soon as it is released. Until next time, goodbye.